This is Haystack Help Radio on KLZ 560. Haystack Help Radio is powered by HaystackHelp.com. Finding help can be like finding a needle in a haystack, but with HaystackHelp.com, finding the needle just got easier. Now, Haystack Help Radio with Scott Whatley on KLZ 560.
Welcome to Protect Your Legacy. My name is Scott Whatley, and our show is brought to you by Blake Harris Law. You can check out the website, BlakeHarrisLaw.com. The number, 833-ASK-BLAKE. And it's always good to have attorney Blake Harris with us. Blake, how are you, sir?
No complaints here. Glad to be back on the show, Scott.
All right. It is always good to have you. And I tell you, this is a topic that is never ending, just to remind people of what they need, how they need to go about it, and just have a complete estate plan. And that is one thing your firm really focuses on, Blake, and that's just taking care of people and having a complete plan that helps in that time of need, right?
Yes, exactly. My firm focuses exclusively on helping individuals and families plan for the inevitable, plan for their incapacity, and plan for their passing. We are fully an estate planning law firm.
All right, good deal. Blake, I guess the first question is, why do you think people tend to put this off for many, many years and sometimes too long, or they don't do it?
Well, I think it's two things. Number one, it's a little bit of a reality check. It requires someone to face up to the fact that eventually we are going to leave this planet behind, and that's a pill that just takes a little maturity to swallow. And in some cases, it takes having a family member or a friend to go through it. A lot of the people who come into my office say, you know, we've been thinking about this for a while, and then unfortunately we had a tragedy strike a family member or a friend, and now we're ready to do it. So sometimes it takes a little bit of reality and a little push to get it done. And then otherwise, some people fear that it's going to be a little bit of a daunting task, and really it does not need to be. Especially when you work with my firm, we do all we can to make the process as simple and easy as possible. We spoon-feed clients throughout the process to make sure they're not overwhelmed with too much information. And we give flat-fee pricing so clients know from the very beginning what they're expected to pay. They're not surprised by any additional charges that they weren't expecting to pay.
Sure. You know, I'm sure as you sit there on a daily basis, and this is all you do every day, so, I mean, as you sit there and if you could compile a list of just the common questions that everybody seems to have, and not that these would rank in any specific order, but what are just some of the common questions that you get when people sit down with you and want to talk about you doing an estate plan for them?
Sure. So one of the most common questions is, what type of estate plan do I need? And there's basically two types of estate plans. There's will-based estate plans, and then there are trust-based estate plans. And some attorneys take the theory that a will is simply all that somebody needs. A will does pass your property when you pass away. However, some attorneys believe that a will is not good enough because, number one, a will is a ticket to the probate court and will steer all their clients into creating a trust. Now, a trust is a more powerful document, and then it can avoid probate. It can provide protection to the beneficiaries from all kinds of things, such as government spin down to qualify for government benefits in the event that you have a child or grandchild that has a disability or a beneficiary that could qualify for government benefits. It also protects the money for the children so that they don't lose it in the event of a lawsuit or a divorce. It can also protect the money, or it also keeps the money out of probate. I take the philosophy that each document is appropriate in certain circumstances. Sometimes I will recommend clients create will plans. Sometimes I will recommend clients create trust plans. It just depends on the client's unique circumstances.
Okay. And then, you know, when you look at all this, so much is about property and all. And so kind of walk us through the steps. You know, someone passes away. How does someone even go about starting all those initial transfers? And I think you just kind of went through it there, whether it's a will or a trust, but what else figures in to when we're really trying to divide up that property and transfer that at death?
Mm-hmm. So the first thing the family is going to need to do, whether it's a personal representative of the will of the estate or the trustee of the trust, they're going to need to make a list of all the assets in the estate. So this is going to include any financial accounts, bank accounts, retirement, 401k, IRA, 403b, all of these financial accounts. And then they're going to need to check to see whether or not those financial accounts have a beneficiary designation in place. If there's a beneficiary designation in place, that trumps anything else. The beneficiary designation trumps the will, trumps the trust. The beneficiary designation will designate what happens to that property. If there's not a beneficiary on a financial account or the beneficiary is not alive, then that money is going to end up going through probate. Hmm. And then at that point in time, the will dictate what happens to the property, whether it's distributed to a beneficiary or whether it's held in trust for a beneficiary. So the financial accounts are one asset to address. The next asset that many individuals own is a home. If you own a piece of real estate and there's a joint owner with rights of survivorship, the joint owner will take over the property. And for married couples, I usually recommend that they should have their own property so that when one passes away, the surviving owner, the surviving spouse takes the property, and there's no need to go through a probate. Now, I don't recommend a setup with your children because you can lose out on step-up and basis, which can end up costing a lot in capital gains taxes. So for leaving property to your children, I would usually recommend a will, a beneficiary deed, or most commonly a revocable living trust. Because by using one of these options, will, beneficiary deed, or a revocable living trust, you can pass the property to your children and still preserve step-up and basis, thus eliminating the need to, thus eliminating capital gains taxes. Okay. And then the third type of asset is tangible personal property, clothing, jewelry, furniture. All of this can be passed down to the beneficiary through the, all of this can be passed down to beneficiaries through either a will, a handwritten memorandum, or through an assignment of your property into your trust, and then your trust will dictate what happens to your main property. So that covers 90% of the assets that most people own, the financial accounts, the real estate, the tangible personal property, and then other assets such as a business or a rental property. Those will be distributed according to the operating agreement or the governing document for that particular business.
Okay. Again, Blake Harris is with us, BlakeHarrisLaw.com, the number 833-ASK-BLAKE, and it's always a free initial consultation. So going back to the beneficiary real quick, you kind of mentioned, you know, if you got a beneficiary and then they're still alive. So does a will that hasn't been updated and that's 20 years old almost present as many problems as if you didn't even have a will?
Well, in some cases, it does. The first thing to note is that a will does not expire. So the will that you sign when you're 19 is still going to be valid when you're 102.
Okay.
Will your family situation change during that time? Absolutely. Will your goals for how you want your property distributed change? Probably. So generally what I recommend is creating an estate plan and putting it together in a way that plans for potential contingencies that covers you for about 10 years. Depending on your age, you're going to want to update and review your estate plan from time to time. Generally, for younger families just starting out, provided there's no divorce, you can go 10 years and not look at your estate plan, and you're probably going to be just fine. For older individuals, baby boomers, those who are retiring, they may want to be visiting their estate plan a little bit more often, especially if you have a blended family. And anytime that there's a major life event, such as a marriage or a divorce, a birth or a death in the family, a major asset is inherited, or a lawsuit arises, then you should definitely consider reviewing and updating your estate plan.
Okay. Now, I think people always just ask, you know, what happens if I die, you know, without a will? And, I mean, you've covered this many times, but we always get new listeners. So what happens in that case?
Sure. So if you don't create your own estate plan, the government will use the estate plan that they have created for you. And in some circumstances, the government does an okay job. If you are a non-blended family, so no stepchildren, chances are you want all of your money to go to your surviving spouse. And then after your surviving spouse passes, you want your money evenly divided among your children. So for the default, for a non-blended or traditional family, I'm not sure if that term's PC, but for non-blended family, the default laws sometimes work appropriately. You still end up going through probate, and there's still the delays and costs and publicity associated with probate, but the money will most of it will still ultimately end up in the hands of the people who want it to receive it. Now, they will also get an outright distribution, which means that they could lose the money quicker. Where I highly recommend you consider consulting an estate planning attorney is if you are a blended family. If either of you have a child from a previous relationship, then the default in Texas laws get a little bit wacky in giving some money to the previous children, some money to the parents. What you don't want to have happen is after your spouse passes away, their children start knocking on your door and taking out the family kitchen, the kitchen table. So yes, there's a default government estate plan for everyone. In some cases, I think it does an okay job. In other cases, a default plan is going to be very far from what you would want.
All right. Now, does this ever happen where someone maybe comes to you and they said, "Hey, I was listed, you know, as a beneficiary of a certain asset, but I didn't get that. I didn't inherit those assets." Are there anything that would ever make that happen?
Of course, estate litigation is prevalent. And so if you are the beneficiary of a will, the beneficiary of a trust, and you have not received an inheritance that you expected to receive, contact my law office or contact another probate litigation firm and explain to them your situation. And you may have a legal right, which you can assert, to receive an inheritance. Now, you may or may not be successful. If mom promised you the mountain home, but a year before mom passed away, she married the pool boy and decided to leave everything to him, and she was of sound mind when she did it, then you may be stuck losing out on the gift. Now, on the other hand, if your 95-year-old mother is updating her will and she's getting forgetful and she's updating it under pressure from an outside party, then you may have a case for undue influence and you may be able to have that new will disregarded. I will tell you that Colorado makes it very difficult to successfully contest a will. So if you have if you're concerned about your family member's estate plan, it is much better to address it while they are still alive than it is to try to work this out after the fact.
Okay.
If you want to have an estate plan that is not going to be contested, there's a few things that I recommend you do. Number one, seek proper legal guidance. If somebody comes to me and says they want to contest a will, the first thing I'm going to say is, was it professionally drafted? If this is a do-it-yourself will or a will that was done at home, I'm going to say we've got a decent chance, we've got at least some chance of contesting this. If they say this was drafted by a law firm, my next question is, was this a law firm that does any type of law that comes through the door, or is this the type of law, or is this done by a law firm that specializes in estate planning? And then third, you want to make sure that it's properly executed, that you have the right witnesses or that you have the right notarization on your estate planning document. So, of course, we can't eliminate any possibility of a contest, but we can do a lot to minimize those risks.
Okay. Be sure and check out BlakeHarrisLaw.com and just read the comments and the testimonials from Blake's clients. Outstanding reviews. And Blake, I know as you sit down with these families, it's a great, you know, satisfaction for you once everything is completed. But man, just reading through all the different reviews over these couple of years that we've been doing the show together, man, what a peace of mind for families to walk out knowing all their bases are covered.
You know, and I hear this often from clients, and it's not even so much when they sign the documents. It's once they contact my law firm, it's once they hire us, they say, I feel good about this already. This mm-hmm. is something that has been weighing on me for a while. All it takes is picking up the phone, giving us a call, 833-ASK-BLAKE, and give us a call right now if you'd like. Somebody will answer or call you back and get you scheduled for a consult within the next few days, and you can be on your way to having your own peace of mind that you've wanted for a while about your estate plan.
Absolutely. Again, that number is 833-ASK-BLAKE, and that is 275-2525. All right, Blake, I'm sure you get this question too, where some people go, estate plan, man, that sounds like something for the wealthy, and I don't really have that much stuff. So how do you answer that?
Well, you know, it's funny. I was talked to probably 50 to 100 people a week or more, and and talking to one individual in the past week, he said to me, you know, I really don't have that much money, but here's my situation. This individual had about $18 million. I had a phone call later that day with another individual who told me several times that he has lots of money, lots of money. That individual had $200,000. I'm not saying that either one was right. I'm not saying that either one was wrong. But a lot of money is what is subjective. It depends on the situation.
Sure.
And if you have $100,000 and you've spent your whole life working to save up $100,000, that's a lifetime's worth of wealth. That is a lot of money. So who am I recommending? Who do I recommend create an estate plan? Well, really, it's more of a question of what type of estate plan. If you're 18 years old, you need to sign a power of attorney. Probably don't need to do much more than that unless you happen to have some assets already. So if you're 18 or older, you've got children who just turned 18, have them sign a medical and financial power of attorney document. That way, if they get hurt while they're in college, if they end up hospitalized, you can interact and speak with doctors. Otherwise, after the age of 18, when you get into your early 20s, or if you're very elderly and have very few assets, I think a simple will may be the right fit. I start recommending an estate plan more aggressively to individuals who either have children or own real estate, because real estate can end up in probate if you don't create an estate plan, and because children, you don't want to leave all of your money, even if it's $100,000 or with life insurance $1 million or more, to an 18-year-old and have them spend through it too quickly, develop irresponsible spending habits. What you want to do is disperse a little bit of that over time, or have another family member manage it so that your beneficiaries don't spend through the money too quickly, so that the money is there to help them. In some cases, money helps people. In some cases, money can hurt people. And you want to make sure that the money that you leave behind for your family empowers them and doesn't enable them.
Sure, absolutely. All right, now what about this matter of like estate tax? You know, you never know what's going to happen with the our government and new things that will come up, but what do people need to know about estate tax?
So here's what you need to know about estate tax. If you've got under $10 million, you don't need to worry about the estate tax. If you're married and you have under $20 million, you don't need to worry about the estate tax. The current estate tax exemption is set at $12 million per individual. If your net worth is over or approaching that amount, then you absolutely should speak with an estate planning attorney. My firm can certainly help with estate tax planning. But for the vast majority of Americans, estate tax is not too much of a concern. The bigger concerns are avoiding probate, reducing capital gains taxes, and setting up an inheritance for a beneficiary so that they don't spend through it or lose it too quickly.
All right, now we're in a do-it-yourself society. Everybody likes to do it themselves, and there's so many outlets out there for different things of printing out forms, fill them in yourself. I always tell people, my personal opinion, that is never a good idea in any legal matter especially. What are some of the pitfalls of someone trying to prepare their own estate plan?
Well, and Scott, I certainly, for my own financial purposes, appreciate you saying that. And I will say that to a degree, I agree with that. I mean, I will say that a do-it-yourself will is probably better than nothing at all.
Right.
Doing something is usually better than nothing at all. I have seen issues where individuals tried doing it themselves or they did it themselves. They made a small mistake and ended up costing their family members thousands or tens of thousands of dollars, and that could have all been avoided just by seeking the proper guidance. Yes, nowadays there is a variety of online and do-it-yourself resources available for someone looking to do just about anything. However, if you work with a estate planning attorney as opposed to trying to do it yourself, you are going to have a much higher level of confidence that your estate plan is properly created and will be properly carried out after you pass away.
All right, good deal. All right, now, and once again, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Protect Your Legacy with Attorney Blake Harris, blakeharrislaw.com. Free initial consultation. Give them a call. They're standing by to help you right now, 833-ASK-BLAKE. Okay, sometimes it's hard to sit down with our parents or grandparents and just ask them, do you have anything written down? And so any icebreaker tips, we'll call it, of how do you approach that subject with loved ones about just wondering, you know, what they've got written down?
You know, it's funny. We are so close to our family members, many of us, and we're comfortable discussing very deep things that we have trouble that we don't communicate with our closest friends. But when it comes to something like money, people get scared and timid about doing it. And I understand we don't want to communicate to our parents that we are interested in receiving anything but love from them. However, I go back to a saying that a friend of mine would say to his daughter, which was, as long as you can ask your parents for money, you still have a good relationship with them, or something along those lines. And as a child, nobody wants to ask our parents for money. However, what happens when you bring up the conversation over and over is parents don't get put off by it. Parents don't get upset by it. These are your parents. They are accepting and loving of you, and simply bringing up the subject isn't a sign that you don't love them. It's a sign that you're being responsible. It's a sign that your parents have done a good job raising you to understand and take care of the important things. And money's not about luxury. I mean, yes, money can buy you luxury or entertainment, but money's about safety and protection. And having a conversation with your loved ones about safety and protection is important. A good way to sell it to your parents is a simple story. Hey, I heard about somebody else who didn't create an estate plan, and their family ended up fighting over the inheritance. They lost a lot of money during the process. We don't want this to happen in our family. Have you done your estate planning, or have you thought about doing your estate plan? Or could I take you to meet with, or can I set up a call and just discuss it with an estate planning attorney? It's going to be a free conversation. Myself, many estate planning attorneys will often do a free I will always, and a lot of other estate planning attorneys as well, will do a free initial consultation. And you'd be surprised. Parents don't, generally speaking, don't get upset or don't mind the conversation. And if they do, back off and leave it on their own. But it's really something that I recommend bringing up if your parents haven't addressed the issue already on their own.
All right. A couple more minutes here with Blake Harrison. Again, his number for a free initial consult, 833-ASK-BLAKE. And it is BlakeHarrisLaw.com. All right, a couple of minutes left, Blake, but what is the role of a trust in the estate plan? And I know we covered that a little bit in the beginning, but just kind of hit that a little bit again.
Sure. So I describe the trust as the heart of the estate, And I have clients call up and say, how much does one of those trusts cost? And to which I respond, well, you don't want a trust. What you want is an estate plan, and a trust would be included with that. And the next question, or another common question, is, well, do I also need a will if I have a trust? And the answer is yes, absolutely. When you create a trust, you should also create a will, a simple pour-over will, which says that any property that is not transferred to your estate before you pass away is transferred to your trust when you pass away. So the will is kind of like an arm that brings everything into the heart of the estate plan. And then the trust is what distributes the money among the beneficiaries, and the heirs. And it distributes the money at the time that you want it to be distributed. So with a trust, you decide who gets your property and when they get it.
Okay. All right, I'm going to approach this last question here in a couple of ways. One, you're looking for that executor of an estate. What attributes does that person need to have? And then the second question is, you know, you've been named it. What should you be willing to do? I mean, let's just explain that role, I guess, and the importance of it, because it's very important.
Sure. So the first thing that I'm going to say that your trustee your executor does not need to be is they don't need to be an attorney. They don't need to be a financial advisor. They don't need to be a CPA. They need to be somebody who is smart enough to know when to hire a financial advisor, CPA, or attorney. They need to be smart enough to know when to hire some help. But more important than anything, it's somebody who you can trust. Trust to manage your money, because they are in a position of trust. And if they wanted to steal money, they're going to be able to. Yes, there's a way of correcting that and clawing the money back if they have assets that can be collected. But as long as you can find somebody you trust, and that can be a family, and that can be a family member, that can be a friend, that can be a professional trustee. And this is very true, not just for your trustee, but for all of your agents, a guardian for your minor children, certainly somebody who you trust, and certainly someone who you believe will raise your children in a manner that you agree with. This is also true for your financial and medical power of attorney, individuals who would step in the event of your incapacity to make a financial or medical decision. You want to have somebody who you trust to manage your money, and you want to have somebody who shares similar feelings about medical treatment that you have as well.
All right. Once again, it is Blake Harris. You've been listening to Protect Your Legacy. Blake also offers free lifetime reviews. And Blake, 30 seconds, why is that important to someone?
Well, so it's important to me because my goal is not just to sell my clients a stack of documents and then a few years later have their situation change. Maybe there's a divorce, maybe there's another child, and then pass away, and the estate plan not reflect their wishes at all. We want to make sure that our clients' plans stay in line with their goals. So we offer flat fee pricing at the beginning. We do charge a nominal fee for future amendments and changes. However, at any time if a client of ours would like to call in just to discuss their estate plan, update us on changing their situations, we do not charge for those calls. Instead, what we do is we do those calls for free because we want to encourage our clients to communicate with us. It's not about getting a trust or a will. It's about having an estate plan, and that's what I want, an estate plan and peace of mind about that estate plan. And that's what we provide for our clients, and that's why we have so many Google reviews, which you can go online and Google Blake Harris Law and read some of our countless number of glowing Google reviews.
All right, Blake. Hey, man, as always, our time goes way too fast. We'll look forward to our next visit. But thanks for being with us again today, sir.
Thank you so much, Scott. Always a fun time to be on your show.
All right. Thank you, sir. Again, you've been listening to Protect Your Legacy with attorney Blake Harris, BlakeHarrisLaw.com. Blake just mentioned, go on, read these reviews, folks. You'll see why Blake is our estate planning attorney here for Haystack Help. 833-ASK-BLAKE. Thanks for being with us today for Protect Your Legacy.
The physical injuries, emotional damage, and economic damages of your case should be accounted for, and sometimes that means going to trial. Kevin Flesh of Flesh and Beck Law is willing to go to court for your personal injury case at no additional cost. Other personal injury attorneys will expect extra money when they take your case to trial. In some cases, they won't do the extra work at all. You deserve an attorney who will get you adequate compensation. He will do his best to get you the fair value of your case and will even take it to trial if necessary. Kevin Flesh with Flesh and Beck Law works on a contingency rather than a retainer. That means they get paid once you get the money and take the same percentage whether you take the money or not. Kevin Flesh wants more for you. Set up a free consultation with personal injury attorney Kevin Flesh to get the legal guidance you deserve. Call 303-806-8886. That's 303-806-8886.
560 KLZ, your home station.
Welcome to Your Health Matters, sponsored by Integrated Health Systems. Traditional medicine has left you frustrated. You've seen doctor after doctor searching for answers, only to feel more confused than ever. Chiropractic neurologist Dr. Shane Stedman, along with his team at Integrated Health Systems, does the detective work you need to identify causes, not just treat your symptoms. Using a team approach to combine functional medicine with neurology, Integrated Health Systems spends the necessary time with each client to find out what's really going on. Thanks to Dr. Stedman and his team, many clients who struggle with debilitating health issues have finally found relief. Now, Haystack Help Radio proudly presents Your Health Matters.
And we'd like to welcome you to Your Health Matters. Again, my name is Scott Whatley. Always good to have Dr. Shane Stedman on with us. Dr. Stedman, how are you, sir?
Oh, I'm good. It's a beautiful Monday, no clouds.
I know. Kind of
nice to see.
We should have called in sick today, huh?
Oh, my gosh.
It is beautiful out there for sure. All right.
I've been traveling a lot.
Oh, have you? Okay.
I think I keep chasing these storms. Every time it's sunny in Colorado, I'm out. Like, dang it.
Well, good deal. Well, Terry, we're going to talk today about something. It is National Autism Awareness Month here in April. And when Dr. Stedman, you told me this would be our topic for today, I looked up and it said about one in every 54 children as of 2020 of this study are affected by this. So kind of give us an introduction to autism, and then we're going to kind of dig into this topic here a little bit.
Yeah, you know, autism definitely kind of runs on a spectrum. Yeah, so you hear of, you know, some people that struggle with, you know, autism that might be very mild, you know, and you would never know. I had an older patient that came in last week, and he didn't come in for that, but he was like, yeah, I got a little bit of autism. I've been diagnosed. And you're like, oh, okay, and, you know, super functional. And then I've had some kids with autism that are definitely not functional. You know, like they need to live, you know, they live with their parents, you know, and it might be older. Mm-hmm. You know, so it definitely has a big spectrum, which really makes it tough too, you know. And I think, you know, for some kids, you know, it's really tough to manage some of their symptoms, and some other kids, people, it might be much easier. So I think the awareness month is kind of good. It's kind of like we talked about with like brain injury awareness month, where I think if you, you know, you don't live in those worlds, you know, it's really hard to understand, you know, what parents go through and what family units go through. And I think the same thing with autism.
Sure.
You know, it's really tough on, you know, some of those kids. And it's really tough on the family unit because, you know, sometimes the mom cannot work, you know, or the dad, you know, whoever. It's a really tough thing. So I think it's good to bring awareness to it because, you know, like we talked about with brain injury, I think if you understand, then sometimes you can have a little bit more, you know, sympathy or caring for people, or maybe reach out saying, like, how can I help, or do you need anything? You know, that it's definitely kind of a bigger issue, and I think it's actually bigger than what we realize, especially in the United States. It seems like those numbers are always big in the United States mm-hmm. versus other countries, and I haven't looked at them, but, you know, it's like, it definitely seems like it's getting more and more of this, like, one out of 54. I mean, you look at a classroom. You know, if somebody teaches math and they have, you know, two classes of, you know, 20 something kids, probably guaranteed to have at least one of those kids, you know. So it's
sure.
I think it's a common thing. So mm-hmm. it's good to have awareness, and it's good to talk about it.
All right. And I was reading one thing, and I wanted to see if you had heard this. It says, while the causes of autism are unclear, a large body of scientific research shows that there's absolutely no link between autism and vaccines. So I'm guessing at some point a lot of people have brought up that they think a vaccine could cause autism. Have you ever heard that?
You always come out of the gates with that one. So here's the thing, and actually it's a very very interesting topic. So it's good to actually touch on this. Was it? I think Jenny McCarthy. I think she's the one that definitely kind of brought that to the forefront.
Okay.
With her kiddo. And so that created a lot of a buzz. Now, here's the interesting thing. We'll talk about causes. And actually, one of my mentors in this realm his name is Dr. Melillo. He's actually the one that founded the Brain Balance Centers that you see all over the place. So like here in Colorado, we have, you know, 3, 4, maybe 5 of them now. But he's the one that founded that. So he's a mentor of mine. I've learned a lot from him over the years. And it's funny, I actually had this conversation with him once. And, you know, I think they're correct. So if you look at the research, right, so you can't technically, you know, prove that the vaccine causes autism. Now, I know there's some people, if they're driving around, like, whoa, and all of a sudden they're going to, like, mm-hmm. you know, scream in their car saying, like, that's not true. I saw that. I actually have had patients that have, you know, that have come in with ADD or autism, you know, those different types of spectrum, childhood spectrum disorders, you know, and the parents said they were perfectly fine until they got the vaccine, and then they were no longer fine.
Yeah.
So here's where the argument comes into play. And I think this is a great topic that we spend forever on. Okay. And we can talk about autism next week and the week after and go through the month of April.
Okay.
This is a good thing to talk about. Now, when you get into autism, you can't technically say that the vaccine caused it. The vaccine might have been the straw that broke the camel's back. So you could have had something, a genetic predisposition. You could have already had some of that in the making. And maybe the vaccine was just the final straw. Mm-hmm. And so when they look at autism and they're looking at causes, there's a lot of different causes, or there's a myriad of things that we can look at. For instance, we can look at hormone imbalances. So there's some links with hormones in autism, especially looking at like an elevation in testosterone. They've also looked at some of the causes in vitro with looking at, you know, motherhood, the pregnancy, how was the mom's health during the pregnancy, and what influences that I have on the fetus during development. Okay. There's also infections, you know, so like, was there like respiratory viruses? Was there strep, you know, that was a childhood, you know, strep? Was there some other kind of condition or some kind of infection that caused it? And so that's where I think it's interesting that I would tell that camp, you're right, but you're also not right. Mm-hmm. Because it's really hard to prove, but there is a large body of evidence saying there are a lot of other things that impact and can lead to, like, the autism developing. And so I think there's the interesting one where I want to believe because I've seen and I've heard what patients say, but also to be fair to the entire spectrum of medicine, it's hard to pinpoint it directly as the sole cause because there might have been three things that went on at the same time and it just was the final straw. Or somebody could have gotten sick and that was the final straw. Or you can look at diet. There's definitely some interesting factors into looking at diet and dyes and, you know, wheat and dairy and food allergies, and there's a lot of pieces that play a role into this mix.
Right. Again, Dr. Shane Steadman is our guest, Integrated Health Systems. And so when I was kind of doing some research on this, it says there are many signs and symptoms that could indicate a person has autism spectrum disorder. Not all adults or children with autism will have every symptom, and some adults and children without autism may display some of the same behaviors and symptoms. So how difficult is that proper diagnosis when working with someone?
It's definitely difficult, you know, because I think a lot of times you go a little bit, or maybe quite a bit, based on symptomatology, you know. And so a lot of times you even hear this, like, well, it looks like your kid might have, you know, something along the spectrum, but we won't fully know until the age of 3 or 4, or even some will say 5. So you hear this kind of a lot in the childhood disorder kind of realm where they say, well, your child will grow into their diagnosis. Hmm. So we'll just wait and see what happens, which is not always the best thing in my opinion either, but this is kind of accounts for why you see like kind of the differences, and that's why they call it like more of a spectrum disorder,
right?
Because not all kids exhibit the same thing. Some are mild, some are severe. So how do you diagnose this? And it almost becomes subjective. I remember I had a patient years ago, and she goes, I think my kid has ADD or ADHD, and I was like, well, okay, you know, I was like, well, I'm trying to like work on the brain, trying to make the brain better. So I mean, if you want that diagnosis, we can do it. But I was like, I kind of actually don't think your kid does. I think we just need to fix these couple things. And I remember she made a comment, well, I'm just going to go to this doctor and this doctor until I get the diagnosis. And I'm like, well, you can definitely do that. You can keep going from doctor to doctor until somebody gives you the diagnosis, because it's very subjective. You know, so if you go to 4 doctors and one of them says, hey, you have ADHD, then you're probably going to say, yep, you're right, and my kid does. And I think that's what sometimes the struggle with some of these conditions like autism is, it can be subjective, but there are definitely some signs and symptoms that go with it, if that makes sense.
Sure, absolutely. And so, again, just some of the things I was looking at, so if you disagree with this, please say so, but it says autism is a lifelong condition, and autism symptoms and autism signs can first appear when a child is very young. Autism cannot be cured. So basically, we're looking at managing something for the rest of their life, right?
I think with most cases, yes. You know, I've seen a few cases over the years where you can improve significantly, you know, some of these kiddos.
Okay.
You know, but I think overall, yeah, I think when you get into the severe autism, you know, cases, and I've had those in my office, yeah, I cannot cure them, and I would not even suggest that. I mean, a lot of them we actually manage and do really, really well. Mm-hmm. I think what's really fascinating is when you look at, you know, if there's some thoughts that it can be genetic. There's also thoughts that it can be an autoimmune condition. And then there's thoughts on the whole like inflammation and testosterone kind of concept. I think those tend to be a little bit easier as far as from a case management standpoint to say, okay, if we reduce your inflammation, you know, we support hormone function, you know, we find maybe the virus that's creating this, you know, creating the issue, and we get that under control. Yeah, that might be one of those cases that, you know, you say, oh my gosh, look at they did it. Like my kid is so much better. I'm so glad I took him to Dr. Stedman. But then you have the other side of the spectrum where, you know, they're really struggling socially, you know, intellectually, you know, education-wise, they need, like, care, they need help. Yeah, those aren't cases that you would say, hey, we can actually, like, just turn this around. And I know some people say they've seen it, and that's super awesome, and I think those cases exist. But I think from a expectation standpoint, most of the time it's, you know, trying to say, like, how can we support your kids so they can do the best they can? Mm-hmm. You know, like I had one kid with autism years ago, and I remember he used to when I first met him, he would scream green bugs, and he would run out the door and run down the street. You know, mom's like, that's not good. I'm like, it's not good. Right. You know, and we got to a point where he stopped seeing green bugs, and he wasn't running, you know, down the street to not be found for like 15 minutes. You know, which is kind of freaky for the parents.
No doubt.
You know, so yeah, we. That was like a big win because he seemed to be a little bit better, not like hallucinating certain images, right? And it's comical after the fact, but obviously for the parent, that's really devastating and tough, right? Mm-hmm. So you sometimes with autism, you know, we say, okay, what are the things that we can do and can we get those wins? You know, can they do better with texture? Can they do better socially? Maybe could they read nonverbal cues better? You know, some of these pieces, can they do that? And can we improve the quality of their life, the family unit, education? So I agree with you. That's kind of a long-winded answer, but...
No, that's fine. Yeah.
Absolutely.
So, you know, you see maybe a couple, they have two or three children, and one child has it. So is this some type of gene that one child got that the other two kids didn't?
Yeah, and that's where it's actually interesting that they've actually looked at some of the genetics around that because it's really fascinating that you see a lot of autism in twins. So there's like a lot of twin studies with that. And and actually the patient I was talking about with green bugs, he actually had his twin, and his twin brother, he was actually quite the opposite. He was, you know, just everything, you know, went perfect for him. I think he played football here in Colorado for one of the universities, you know, so, you know, had everything going for him. And then his twin brother, you know, saw green bugs and lives at home and, you know, and was struggling. Right. And so it's really fascinating that they go, well, okay, how much does genetics play a role? You know, did this twin take on a genetic and this one didn't? And I think that's why there's so much research. And I think that's why you see a lot of, you know, fundraising for like Autism Speaks, you know, because I think they're trying to figure this out, like how much is genetics and what can we do and what are all the different things that play a role. So when you have these huge organizations and local organizations, they're constantly trying to raise money for awareness and autism. I think that's what we're all trying to figure out is all the pieces, because it's kind of weird and complex at the same time.
Sure. Absolutely. All right. Now, some of the things that I read were common signs that may indicate a person has autism, and I'll just run through these real quick and let you comment, but avoiding eye contact, delayed speech and communication skills, being upset by relatively minor changes, unexpected reactions to sounds, tastes, sights, touch, and smells. So touch on any of those that you would like.
Well, so it's interesting about all of those and kind of when you get into autism. So I'll touch on that, but... Here's kind of the interesting piece on autism. So if you look at Dr. Melillo's research and some of the research that's come out of Israel, and they're looking at these like functional neurology, functional neuro disconnects, it really kind of interesting how they start looking at right brain and left brain. And a lot of these conditions with autism, and we'll say even the spectrum of like ADD, autism, Asperger's and things like that, you actually look at more of an overactivity of the left cortex or the left brain and or an underactivity of the right part of the brain. You primarily see that this also involves the frontal lobe. And the frontal lobe is that part of the brain that's allows you to make eye contact, that allows you to be patient so that you're not interrupting, you're not being impulsive, you're making good decisions. That's all frontal lobe. And so a lot of things that you described, and this is what you see a lot of times in with autism, is that that frontal lobe isn't developing as well as you should. And so you start seeing a lot of impulsivities and interrupting, eye contact, social cues, even just like inappropriate, inappropriateness. I've seen that with some patients where they do things and say things that obviously they don't understand what they're doing, but mm-hmm. you have to control it because it can be misconstrued as something else. You see a lot of that, and that's frontal lobe. Now, when you get into the left part of the brain being overactive, it's really fascinating because the left brain is part of your like analytical brain. So sometimes like you see kids on the spectrum and they are highly intelligent. You know, they are so smart, you know, and the right brain, you start looking at right brain, left brain, as far as like interacting with people, and your right brain tends to be a little bit more like engaging mm-hmm. where your left brain is a little bit less. So you see these like very high intellectual kids that really struggle socially. But, you know, my wife had a stepbrother that had Asperger's. And I remember he watched the movie Apollo 13 back in the day. And after he watched the movie, he took a bunch of Legos and he made this entire like spaceship, space station, you know, and I was just right. like, whoa, that was impressive. Like he could literally take anything apart and put it all back together.
Yeah.
And it was just brilliant. You're just like, how can this kid not talk to people and struggle in school, but see something and build it like exact replicas, right? And that's what you kind of see with these like overactive, dominant left brains, is that they can, man, if you want something like put together, they could probably like put all that together. But then if you're like, hey, come and let's have a conversation and go to a birthday party, they're like, oh, I'm out. I can't do it. And you start seeing that right brain, left brain imbalance, and you start seeing that frontal lobe imbalance. And that's kind of where a lot of the autism spectrum research has come out. And that's what they're trying to figure out is why. And
right.
I think that's kind of going back to what we were talking about earlier.
Right. Dr. Shane Steadman is with us, Integrated Health Systems. Their number is 303-781-5617. And then just a couple other items on here. It said children not responding to their name by 12 months, children not pointing at distant objects by 14 months. So maybe that can lead into kind of some of the testing that you may do with a young child.
Absolutely. You know, so when you start looking at these kids, you know, that's a lot of what we start looking at. We start looking at like things like right brain, left brain, and how well can you see things versus like being up close and analytical, you know, like putting Legos together versus like seeing things at a distance and knowing what's going on. You know, there is a lot of testing that's kind of done that helps us get some clues, you know, like the frontal lobe, for instance. If you see a lot of these primitive reflexes that should be gone by the age of two and they're still floating around, then it gives you some clues that frontal lobe's not developing very well, you know, or if, you know, kid isn't, you know, if their right brain doesn't work, how's the left side of their body doing? Can they, you know, can they coordinate and have like motor function? And a lot of times you see kids like this, they just don't do well in sports because they're not very coordinated. So, yeah, so that's where all the, like, the neuro testing comes into play, where you can almost, like, map it out. Like, how's their right brain? How's their left brain? How's their frontal lobe? How's their temporal lobe? How's their parietal lobe? You know, and we start kind of working on improving those areas of the brain.
Right. Now, this one, Dillard, said there's five different types of autism, real quick, and just get you to comment. You just mentioned the Asperger's, and then there's Rett, R-E-T-T syndrome, childhood disintegrative disorder, Kanner's, K-A-N-N-E-R-S syndrome, and pervasive developmental disorder. So are these just different types, or would you describe this more as different stages of autism?
I would probably say different types. And where I would go with that is, I think what's interesting is, and I said years and years ago, I was kind of reading on this, and it was kind of interesting because it's almost like, They try to label a lot of these because not everybody fits into the same box.
Right.
You know? And so, you know, so if you have a kid or somebody that has autism, but they don't quite have the autism like this other kid, well, then how do you categorize that? You know? And so they've even like had like, you know, different types and subtypes. And I think what you're basically saying is, you know, we have like maybe a frontal lobe, you know, and maybe the limbic system's involved. You know, so maybe they do a lot of hitting and biting and, you know, something like that, versus maybe this is more of a frontal lobe issue with a parietal lobe issue. So maybe there's like this weird, you know, lack of awareness or perception, you know, or awareness of others, you know, something like that. And so I think they're trying to say like, well, what are the different flavors? How do we categorize those? And so I think that's where you start seeing like the names and the types and the severities that come into play. Mm-hmm. Because it sometimes does get really confusing, you know, trying to figure out, well, it's kind of, you see the same thing like Parkinson's sometimes. Like you have Parkinson's syndrome, Parkinson-like disorder, Parkinsonism, Parkinson. You know, it's like all these different subtypes, because they're trying to categorize, well, they kind of look like somebody that has Parkinson's, but they don't have all of the pieces. So how do we label that? And I think it's just trying to come up with different labels.
Right. So last 3 or 4 minutes here, but let's kind of talk about the parent side real quick, and then we can delve into this more next week. But you know, you get the young couple, whatever, you know, they have their child, comes up with autism, and then they're in your office. And how much time is spent, and certainly if anyone understands, you and your wife do, but how do you kind of work through with parents? Because I'm sure that's 50% of the help that they need. It's just, how do they deal with it too, right?
Yeah, I think that's the hard part. You know, there's obviously a lot of stress in, you know, in the family unit. And there's a lot of grief, you know.
Sure.
Because, like, that's not, you know, when you're thinking about having a kid and you conceive and you're getting excited about this, and then, you know, your whole world changes. And, you know, and I this is one of my favorite poem things, and so I'll throw it out there for people who've never heard about it. Most people in that world have probably heard this poem, but it's called Welcome to Holland. You know, so it's like the whole premise is like you book a flight to Italy and you end up in Holland. You're like, how did I get here?
You know? Right.
It's a great, great, great poem, but it's called Welcome to Holland. You know, I think it's hard. I think that's the hardest piece is how do you support mom and dad and the family? Because a lot of times there's counseling and self-care, and you can almost say that flippantly, but they would probably look at you like you're like crazy to say like, oh, you need better self-care. They're like, are you serious? Have you hung out in my house and lived with me? So I think we try as best as we can to support the parents and educate the parents, hug on them, love on them. You know, it's just beyond hard with, you know, people that have kids with autism. It's super hard. And I've seen a lot of moms and dads like, you know, break down and, you know, just crying from just the amount of stress. So, again, I think that's why Autism Awareness Month is great, because we can know what those families go to. And if you, you know, want to support some of these places like Autism Speaks, and, you know, volunteer your time, your money, or, you know.
Sure.
Because I think families need help.
Oh, for sure. So let's say, you know, a child has autism, then does it progressively get worse as they get into adulthood, or is it kind of as bad as it's going to be, and then you just have to see how they develop and deal with it and get treatment like as someone with yourself?
Yeah, I think the second is probably more, you know, true, because I think everybody can kind of develop a little bit differently. Sometimes it does set, you know, and then what happens is you know, maybe have a kiddo that is kind of virtually the same, but now they're, you know, 6'2", 230-pound kid with autism.
Yeah, really, yeah.
You know, and like, how do you deal with that? Where maybe it was a lot easier when they're like, you know, 5 foot and 60 pounds, you know? But, I mean, because it's, you know, because you, how do you restrain somebody, which are, you know, that's a whole other topic. But, you know, how do you manage the situation or manage them, you know, when you have that? And I think it just makes it harder. So, like, I think it just poses different issues when you get a kiddo that might be 25 years old, you know, they can't work, it doesn't know their surroundings, you know, and they're kind of like a bowl in a china shop, you
sure
know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Just like your whole world is so different, and so I think it's just hard to manage that, and it's hard to know, and some kids grow into it, some kids get worse, and
I'm sure, you know, the couples have a very difficult time, you know, and just struggling how to discipline, because maybe you can't discipline like you would a child. You know, that's not affected with autism. So, boy, what a balance and what a something to go through every day to just try to figure out how you can help that child. What a journey.
Exactly. Yeah, but I think at the end of the day, to wrap it up in 20 seconds, because I know we're getting to the end, is like there are things that can be done, and there are things you can look into, and you can look into diet and therapies and exercises and brain-based therapies. There are things to do, so it's not quite a dead-end road, and there's always things to try out there. There's always still a little bit of hope to make some cool changes.
Yeah, well, folks, we're going to be going through this all through the month here of April, so I hope you'll join us. Again, it's Integrated Health Systems. Dr. Shane Steadman and his team, Dr. Perry Maynard, joins us, so I hope you will as well every Monday here at 12:30. So, Dr. Steadman, thank you so much, sir, and we'll look forward to our visit next week.
All right, Scott.
All right, that's Dr. Shane Steadman, Integrated Health Systems, integratedhealthdenver.com, 303-781-5617. Hope you have a great rest of your day.
Call Integrated Health Systems now for a free consultation, 303-781-5617. That's 303-781-5617. To book your consultation online, visit integratedhealthdenver.com. Thank you for listening to Your Health Matters. Be sure to join Dr. Shane Steadman live every Monday at 12:30 p.m. on KLZ 560.
The views and opinions expressed on KLZ 560 are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of Crawford Broadcasting, the station, management, employees, associates, or advertisers. KLZ 560 is a Crawford Broadcasting God and Country station.